So summertime brings a lot of milestone celebrations, right? How many of you have been to an open house already this year? Several? Yeah. Wallets feel a little bit lighter, right? And then how many of you have been to a wedding so far this year? Quite a few, yeah. So there have been a lot of going on, a lot of things going on. And so summertime, that brings these milestone celebrations. So you got the open houses, you got the weddings, but then there's even the smaller milestones, like a trip that you've been looking forward to all year. Forward to getting back to your vacation destination if you have one that you go to, or maybe you set up a cruise for a first time, or maybe you're just looking forward to a road trip and getting out of Dodge for a little bit, getting away from responsibilities. That can even be a milestone for the year at least. And in a lot of cases, though, when we look at those things, the question becomes, what's next? Right? That's the question that you ask the graduate at the open house. What are you going to do next? Isn't it? Oh my goodness, it stinks answering those questions all day long, but you get really good at the answer. And then the married couple that just had their wedding, when are you going to have kids? Right? Like, what's next? Is where are you going to live? When are you going to have kids? Where are you going on your honeymoon? What is next after this celebration? And then even after the trip, when's the next trip? Where are we going to go next? Right? Like, that's how we live our lives. We spend a lot of our lives figuring out what we're going to do next, what we're supposed to do next. What am I supposed to do with my job? What am I supposed to do with my family right now? What am I supposed to do with this pain that I'm carrying around? What am I supposed to do with this life? Those are questions that we're all going to ask from time to time, and they're questions that really do matter. But every once in a while, another question kind of bubbles up underneath of that question. It's a deeper question. It's not just, what should I do, but what kind of life am I actually living? What kind of life am I actually living? It's possible to do a lot of things and still feel unsettled. It's possible to be responsible, to be helpful, to be busy, to be even religious, and still wonder why something inside of you still feels a little bit shaky, a little bit unsteady. And I'd call that a stressful experience. Something feels off, but I can't explain it. It nags, even though everything on the surface looks pretty good. Have you ever heard someone say, "I don't know why I feel the way I do, because my life is the way that, like, I can't complain about anything that I've got around me, but something still feels off. I don't understand." It nags even through everything that's good. You got the roof over your head, food in your belly, family is present. I got friends, but something just doesn't feel right. You know, the only analogy that I could really come up with for that is sometimes we feel hungry when our body is actually thirsty. Have you ever noticed that before or heard about that? That's a real phenomenon. Sometimes our body says we interpret the signal as hunger, but we're actually just in need of some water. And what that tells us is that we can misdiagnose some of these things. What we want can go misdiagnosed. What happens if you get a misdiagnosis from your doctor? You don't get better, right? And you might end up in a worse spot than where you were in the beginning, and you might end up in a lawsuit, or you might end up dead, right? Like, that's the danger of misdiagnosing something. And so we need to pay attention to this misdiagnosis of the things that are going on in our soul, because sometimes we attribute that longing to work or not enough time off from work. Sometimes we assign the unsteadiness to the families that we've built. Sometimes we name it as guilt and regret. Sometimes we just ignore it and we try to learn how to live with it and just dull the voice of it all the time. But today, the scriptures are going to clearly diagnose what's going on, so you can prepare for the day that unsteadiness hits you. Or maybe I'm talking directly to something that you've been feeling for the last little while. And today, God is going to be a light to your path and show you where to look for freedom from that unsteadiness. So we're going to start here. Your soul is longing. Your soul is longing. That's the unsteadiness that you're feeling. That's not a weakness. We need to make sure that we understand that right at the outset. Longing is not a weakness. I'd actually call it a feature of being human. It's a feature of humanity in this world that drives us toward what will bring us to calm and joy, right? Would you ever eat if you never felt hunger? I mean, if it tasted good, right? But like, if I never felt thirsty, I don't know that I would be prompted to go up and get water, right? If I never had an itch, I would never scratch. Make sense? Like, if we don't have something that's kind of poking and prodding us, something that doesn't feel a little uncomfortable, we're not often motivated to do something. And so I call this a feature of humanity that will drive us toward bringing calm and joy in our lives, bringing peace, bringing us to God. Think about what it is to long for something. We're not well trained in this because, at least with the little pleasures of life, we don't have much to long for. I can get an ice cold Pepsi at about 3 or 4 places on my 8-minute drive into work if I wanted to, right? Like, that's available to me. And if I want a steak, I can pinch some pennies in my budget and pick one out at several different stores in this area, right? There's like, you know, if I don't like the marbling in this one, I can go to another place and say, do you got better marbling? You know, if it's not the right size, I can, if I wanted to, I could drive around all over the place and figure out where I can get the best steak. And if I save up a little bit longer, I can go and probably have at least, I can have one of at least 10 chefs in the area make a steak for me, right? Like, we don't know what it is to long. When we have a craving, we meet that craving, right? When we have a desire, we meet that desire. When we want something, we get it. We're not well practiced in longing, at least in the little things. So when we don't practice the little things, we have no framework or foundation for what the greater feeling of longing creates in us. What is something else that you need to practice little things in order to get good at the big things? What are some of the little disciplines in life that have helped you accomplish greater things in life? Exercise. Okay. Going for a walk every day, right? Taking the stairs instead of the elevator. That's no fun, is it? Because you take the stairs for the first time and you're like, you know. Musical instrument. Anytime you try to learn a new skill, I know that from, that's one of the more disciplined skills that I've learned over the years. And every time you start a new instrument, you have to learn the basics first. You cannot jump. Man, when I started learning how to play guitar, I so badly wanted to learn how to like just rip a solo, you know, and scream on that. But my fingers didn't work. They weren't trained in how to hit the strings at the right, hit the right string at, on the right fret, right? Those of you that have learned how to cook, you have to learn the basics of what spices go well together, right? You have to learn what it is to use the right heat, when to put the butter in so as not to scorch it. It makes sense? You catching what I'm driving at, right? Here, there are little disciplines in life. And so when we get into the emotional side of things, it's the little breakups when we were elementary age kids having a crush on one another that really didn't mean a whole lot. And we got introduced to the idea of pain when someone doesn't like you anymore, right? They send you the note, or at least we had the football notes, right? Because we didn't have cell phones when we were kids. And you couldn't just get a text message. And so you'd get a note and it would be like, I don't like you anymore. And, you know, elementary age, right? And it's like, I had a girl stick her tongue out at me one time to let me know that she was done with me. Her name was Candace. I can give you her address later. I'm kidding. But here's the thing with that. Little disciplines. When we don't practice the little things, we have no foundation for how to handle the bigger things. We lack experience in small longings, which doesn't leave us with much of a foundation or framework for what bigger longings look like. But in Psalm 15, David starts with this soul-level longing for the Lord. Chapter 15 of Psalms, verse 1, says, Lord, who can dwell in your tent? Who can live on your holy mountain? David is certainly exploring wisdom here. Now, when we first come to this, when we first read this, we look at this almost, for me, maybe not you, but I think for a lot of people, we look at this as an academic question. We look at this as a quiz. We look at this as an information dump. Like, okay, David's asking this question. He's going to give us the answer. And he is. But this isn't only a quiz question. This isn't only wisdom. This is not just information. It's meant to inspire wonder. Everybody say wonder.
Wonder.
There we go. David is going to give us answers. But it's meant to inspire wonder, and it reflects the question of what the soul wants. A soul that longs to be near to God. It makes sense that if we were created by God, that we would long to be near to God, right? He says, who can dwell in your tent? That's a callback to something that happened in Israel's history. It was a callback to the mobile temple that we call the tabernacle. They called the tabernacle that the Israelites had in the wilderness. It was a place where God's people met with God. A place where God lived among his people. And the way it was set up, the tabernacle was at the center of their traveling camp as they wandered through the wilderness. So anytime they set up, the tabernacle would get set up in the middle and they would camp out around it. There's a kind of a artsy-fartsy illustration of what that may have looked like. The tabernacle is red, dead center, and then you have all of the people that are all around it. It was the city square, so to speak. It was what was centralized in their lives. It was meant to depict God at the center of their existence. And that's ultimately what David is asking in this question. He's saying, who can be in your presence? And then David says the same thing in a different way in the next question. He says, the holy mountain of the Lord points us to two places. The holy mountain of the Lord. It'll point us to two places. The Garden of Eden is the first one I want to point out. It was God's dwelling place here on earth. Remember when in Genesis, when it says that in the evenings, in the cool of the day, the Lord would walk with Adam and talk with Adam? That gives me goosebumps to think about it. Like, some of y'all like evening walks when it's getting cooler and kind of wind down from the day and listen to some of the nature sounds, and I just imagine that being a godly desire, right? Because Adam would get up and walk with God in the cool of the day, would spend time with him as the day wound down, maybe review the day, maybe talk about frustration, you know, this lion wasn't doing what he was supposed to do, and that tree, you know, had a fruit that didn't taste very good. Why'd you create that, God? Like, wouldn't that be awesome to have access to God like that and just be able to have that kind of conversation? Like, God's presence in the Garden of Eden. Now, we can surmise that the garden was elevated on a hill because in Genesis chapter 2, it talks about how one river flows into the Garden of Eden and four rivers flow out of it. And what that is meant to this little detail that we often miss, it symbolizes God's presence flowing into the garden and flowing out in different directions all over the world. Like, they all go in different directions from that one place. It's the river of God, right? The second place is the temple in Jerusalem that was built in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. Much like the tabernacle, it is centrally located in the city and where God dwelt on earth. Again, it was the heartbeat of the city, the people who lived there. I think that it's common for us to think of, if we knew where the Garden of Eden had been, we would go and visit it, right? Like, that would be a tourist destination for a lot of people of faith. And a lot of people make a trip to Israel to see the Temple Mount, right? Like, they can't get to it in our current times, but they can still see it. They can still experience it. They can go up to the Wailing Wall. They can walk where Jesus walked, and people do travel there, sometimes for education, sometimes for the experience of it all, sometimes just to be in the presence and make the Bible come alive even more as they read through it. But ultimately, all it is a destination. none of us have made the decision to go and live there on God's holy mountain, right? It's a place we might briefly visit. In the Bible, that language is sojourn. Have you ever heard that word? A sojourner? Someone who stops briefly and moves on. David here isn't asking, who can come and visit you, God? He's asking, who can live with you in your tent on your holy mountain? See, David isn't, the longing that David is expressing here is not a visit with God or from God. He's not thinking like, oh, I have an achy back, right? So I need to go to the chiropractor to have him adjust it. I think sometimes that's how we treat church. Like, I've had a bad week, so I'm gonna go to church this week so that I can get adjusted and have a better week next week, right? Anybody guilty? I'm guilty of that. Any of you guilty of that? Let's just be honest, right? No liars in church. All right, come on now. We do that. Oh, I better start reading my Bible, praying more, sing a song. I better listen to a sermon because things aren't going great and I need an adjustment. What David is saying is, who can take up residence with you, God? Who can be in your presence? Who even longs to be in your presence? It's the cry of the heart of someone who longs for God more than anything else in life. And this is a desire. This is a want. This is that longing. It's one that we misdiagnose often. Kind of like this phenomenon where you are hungry, or you think you're hungry, but you're thirsty. It's a real thing. But built-in longing has been corrupted in us too. The emotional longing. We think that more money is the answer, the comfort is the answer, a person is the answer, being right is the answer, or more information is the answer, when in fact what our souls are longing for is the nearness, the intimacy, the communion with our God. Who can live with you in your tent or on your holy mountain, God? Those questions of longing to be with God are like the bride to, like how the bride to be longs to be with her groom. But when this longing rises up in us, we do all sorts of things to get close to life, except the thing that would actually make it happen. You've probably recognized this. I think about things as simple as, since we've talked hunger and thirst, I think about hangry feelings, right? How many of you struggle with getting hangry from time to time? Yep, okay, I'm good, glad I'm not alone, all right? You get hungry, and how do you change when you get hangry and not just hungry? Grumpy? Hateful? Ooh, Margaret. Dang. Way to confess this morning. All right. I love it. Anything else? Impatient. This is where that old saying, make me a sandwich, comes from. Maybe a little bit, you know? I'm hungry. We need to go now. You get impatient. You get snippy. You get unloving. You get less sympathetic. You lose a lot of those qualities. So we're not actually starving in that moment. I think we understand that. But just that little thing pushes us to do things that we might claim are not illustrations of who we really are. But think about that logic for a second. If every time, or most of every time, that you get hungry and you don't get the food exactly when you want it, and that is how you react to know that you identify it that way, is that or is that not who you really are? Like, that's a question we need to ask ourselves. Because that's not who we want to be, but if we can't resist that, that's kind of, that we got to admit that's who we are, right? And other times when we're comfortable, when we're strong, when we're feeling content, we're able to control it, right? We're able to push that down and be like, okay, just be patient, you know, and we can kind of talk ourselves off that ledge. More seriously, when our reputation is challenged or we're facing financial hardship or when we're uncomfortable in a relationship, we often start trying to take that life that we've feel is earned or is owed to us. We try to start taking it back. We feel like it has been stolen from us, right? When somebody comes after your reputation, your response is to go after theirs. That's the instinctual response. That is, they're taking life from me, so I'm going to take it back from them. This is a war. When we go through financial hardship, we start looking for ways to cheat systems. We start looking for ways to get what maybe we have not earned. We start trying to figure those things out. It takes us away from who we desire to be, who God has called us to be, and we start, instead of entrusting ourselves to the one who gives life, we start trying to take life from the world. When God doesn't create life, all we're doing is stealing life. Are you tracking with me on that? God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. God, I've heard stories where God has mysteriously made things appear for people. He has sent people to graciously give away. And it became that action of generosity, instead of it being stealing, instead of it being taking, it was actually life-giving for both sides. One person was blessed with the means to engage in life, and the other person was blessed by God to be used by God in an act of generosity, and they feel fulfilled in carrying out God's purposes. You see how that's different from us just taking? Well, you have too much, so I need some, right? This is the mark of generosity. This is actually being talked about at a cultural level right now. I'm not getting into that. We're not going politics today, but think about that. This is a big conversation right now. You have too much. You should be more generous, so I'm going to take from you, strip you of the opportunity to be more generous. It doesn't create life for anyone. I had a lighthearted conversation this week with someone who was surprised at where their mind went when they were facing a particular hardship. And they prefaced it with, not anybody that goes here to church, but they prefaced it with, I know you're a pastor and everything, but, and I know what I'm about to get is juicy. Like, I'm like, I'll bring it. Yes, let your guard down. Let me hear it. And when they were finally finished, they were just talking about some of the evil thoughts that they had as someone hurt them. And I had to admit that just because I have a title does not make me any less human, because I've had those thoughts too. Am I alone in that? No. We all have. My point in all of these illustrations is to show you that when we start feeling a lack of life, we start trying to steal it back. As we read through the rest of the psalm, keep that in the back of your mind. When we start feeling that lack of life, we start trying to steal it back. That's our instinct. And David's answer to his own question then, he says this in verse 2, "The one who lives blamelessly practices righteousness and acknowledges the truth in his heart." As hard as I try to live blamelessly, I can't claim that. And I don't want to speak for you, so I'll ask you the question. Anyone in here figured out life so as to say that you live blamelessly? Awesome. You're like, I didn't have to raise my hand this morning. Great. Awesome. Everybody. See, that's something we all have in common. We all have common ground in this particular realm. We've all failed this test already. But David could have stopped there and ended up where he was going anyways, but he's going to drill down. He's going to cycle down. So watch where he goes. The one who practices righteousness and acknowledges the truth in their heart. I think on the surface, it might be easy to claim that we're doing okay here, that we practice righteousness and that we acknowledge truth. But if you go deeper beyond the saying of, yes, I believe the Bible is true, and start looking at the harder examples of Scripture, we might not be able to say either of these things about ourselves. We've all got vices. And there are things in the pages of Scripture about God that we find hard to accept. Or even believe. But what this is driving at is the unity between what we do, what we think, and what we say. Because we've all said things we don't mean, especially when we're longing for something. What we think sometimes doesn't line up with what we say. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Oh, I really like that shirt on you. And in the car, in the ride home, duh. You know? And what we do sometimes doesn't line up with what we say or think. We deny what is true because sometimes we just don't want it to be true. Have you ever known someone caught in denial? Yeah. They just can't see it. They won't admit it. We deny truth. You and I have both done it too. We've been caught ourselves in denial. Or we know what is true and we use it to make ourselves feel better at someone else's expense. That's called self-righteousness, by the way. I'm right, you're wrong, and so I feel better because I'm higher than you. I'm on a higher pedestal. I'm farther ahead than you. I'm more accomplished than you. Both of these things ignore the real longing in our souls and even try to make it go away. And this list that David is building gets bigger. In verse 3, he says, "Who does not, the one who can live with the Lord in his tent on his mountain, does not slander with his tongue, who does not harm his friend or discredit his neighbor." Now he's getting more specific, right? We find ourselves in a state of longing. When we find ourselves in a state of longing, sometimes it feels good to bring someone else down. Your ex, for instance. It might feel good to talk poorly about them because in some twisted way it makes us feel better about ourselves. The same can be said for a coworker, a politician, or an entire group of people, like a generation or a political view who subscribe to a different thought process, a different way of thinking than you do. He's saying that the one who can dwell with the Lord, who gets access to the life that we long for, ought not speak badly of others, ought not gossip about them or lie about them. The one who can dwell with the Lord doesn't bring pain to others, doesn't ridicule others, doesn't mock or make fun of other people. And again, in some ways, this feels like life. Like when you're in a group of friends, and this is maybe especially true with guys, it's so much fun to poke fun at other people. Right? Because it gets laughs. It's so much fun to find the guy that's like the weak gazelle in a group of lions, right? And you just like, oh, we're going in. And all the guys laugh and the poor gazelle is over there laughing too, but it's inside, it's like bleeding out, you know? Ladies, you're probably, stereotypically, I admit, but you're probably a little more susceptible to gossip, right? No. I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm just trying to say that tends to be, guys don't tend to gossip about things. Girls do. Guys tend to like really just hammer home at people, you know. But think about that. Why do you gossip? Because it feels good to be the one in the know, right? It feels good to make someone else's jaw drop. Like, really? Like for whatever reason, someone saying that just like energizes us. And I don't know why. Both of those things bring life to us at the expense. We're stealing life from somebody else instead of allowing God to bring us life. We're centering ourselves around something other than the presence of God when we engage in that. Here's what that shows, though. What it shows is that you are longing for life. Why shouldn't we gossip? Well, it steals life from someone else. The place to get what you really, that life that you're really longing for is not in these actions. It's in the Lord. Because why else would we do it? Well, I racked my brain to try and figure out an answer to that because I don't know why else we do it. And yet we all have done it from time to time. Maybe still even participate in it. I don't know why you hop on social media in the infamous Lapeer News and Discussion group and it is just, people will ask a simple question like, I don't know, what food, I think I saw yesterday, what food do you feed your dog? And people were jumping all over them, like just for no reason because it makes them feel better. There's no reason to do that. Verse 4 says, "The one who despises, or I'm sorry, who despises the one rejected by the Lord, but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps his word, whatever the cost. So we've moved from broader principles now to more practical things that we might say or do, to now what's hiding in the heart. The question here, I think, is where does the honor we have to give go? This is a portrait of someone who doesn't get excited by evil, one who despises those who have rejected God, someone who respects those who fear God, someone who keeps their promises and commitments even if they're tiring and costly. Now, in all sincerity, like, Christians are sometimes the worst at keeping commitments and responsibilities and adhering to the things that they very well preach. We all know that, right? There are Christians in name only, we could say. Some of us go through a really rough season and we do not represent Christ well. There's grace for that. But if we're pursuing the Lord seriously, if we're fearing the Lord seriously, chances are we are going to keep our commitments, right? There's going to be a level of responsibility that is associated with that. My word has value, in other words. And so when I make a promise, I'm going to keep that promise. I don't want to spread lies, so I'm going to speak truth. And so I was a little off put when I saw who despises the one rejected by the Lord, right? And because we just kind of got done saying, let's not be mean to each other in a sense, right? Despising someone feels a little bit hard. What? Mean, yeah. Keep this in mind. Despises the one rejected by the Lord. Who's the one rejected by the Lord? Keep that in the back of your head as we go on. Then the first part of verse 5. We're going to read just the first part. Who does not lend his silver at interest or take a bribe against the innocent? The person who enters the residence of the Lord is someone who has absolute integrity in their financial dealings. They do not lend to people in order to make a profit, and they are not susceptible to bribes. Now, I want to make one quick comment here because I think that this is an opportunity to teach on this. I've come across people who have said, the Bible should be free. And maybe some of you are in that camp. That's fine. There are free Bibles out there. The Berean, I think it's just the Berean Bible, is one that is completely free. You could print it off and not face any kind of copyright issues and all that kind of stuff. What this does not say is one cannot sell things for a profit in order to make a living, right? And so you can go into business. I know that that might be, for some of you, like, but some folks think that Christians should just give everything they have away and take an involuntary vow of poverty. I don't think that's actually right. What he's talking about here is using someone in a time of need in order to benefit you. When someone is in need of money, is in need of a loan, no, we have a little bit of a different thought process on this today because we get loans for everything, I think. I mean, you get on Amazon now and it's like 3 payments, you know, and that's a loan, you know, that's a loan. Who does not lend his silver at interest so as to make a profit and potentially put someone in a worse spot than where they started off with. This is taking life from somebody else. You're seeing the theme, right? You're taking advantage of someone else. Or take a bribe against the innocent. If you need to take a bribe against the innocent has been accused of something that they did not do. And they are in a position where someone is mounting up a framing of them. They're in a rough spot. And so if you know they're innocent and you take a bribe, you're stealing their life from them. So it's not, this is not to be stripped from its context in this psalm to say, well, we should not be making a profit at all. No. This is profit in the expense of life. We're stealing something greater than their money from them. We're stealing their hope. We're bringing them to despair. And so David is taking this and saying, look, pay attention. And so what we see in these, there's been 10 qualifications that David has listed. 10 things that David says, this is what the person who can walk into the dwelling place of God, this is what they look like. This is what they do. This is how they live their lives. And it can be a list of 10 qualifications that we can strive for in order to be godly people, and it's certainly been used in that way. But what is David's point in presenting this? This isn't going to feel good. But this is a picture of a person that doesn't really look like us at all. I've slandered you. I've lent money at interest in order to take advantage of somebody's hardship. I've probably made 1,000 or more assumptions in my life about people, and I didn't practice or believe the truth. I've denied things. I don't walk blamelessly. I don't live righteously. I think less of people who drink Coke. Right? Like, oh, man, it's even in this room. We need to have an exorcism now, okay? No, I'm kidding. This is a picture of a person that does not look like you or me very much at all. This is exposing, and I understand it's not fun to be exposed. We all have these horrible dreams where you're in a public speaking setting and you're standing in front of everyone in your underwear or worse, right? You've been there? Okay, maybe it's just me because I do this, but that is the worst feeling. You're like, woo! You know, it's not a good dream. And similarly, this isn't a psalm that we're going to buy artwork of and hang in our homes. It doesn't feel good to walk through qualifications and realize that we meet few of them, if any. And so this psalm means to humble us before it comforts us. It means to humble us before it comforts us. It's meant to show us that in this moment we stand before God condemned. Even as we've assembled today, we might use language that we want to, or that we even expect God to be in our presence here, to be in the presence of God as we hear from the Word, as we sing songs, as we pray together, as we love one another. But if access to God were based on our integrity, on our righteousness, on our truthfulness, and our love for neighbor, none of us could demand His presence here. None of us could. And so David is pointing this out to us. He reminds us that we will never be the kind of person who can enter God's presence. This psalm exists to help us then identify the longing that's in our hearts, to teach us to cry out for mercy when maybe we have assumed that it is God's privilege to meet with us here, as if we are so obedient, and if He owes us to pick us up from the war that we've been going through. And this psalm reminds us that God owes us nothing. Whenever we get on our high horse and we start saying, God, why aren't you? It's time to check ourselves real quick. It's okay to ask that question. It's okay to even accuse God of not doing what you think He should do. God's big enough to handle that. God wants that honest confession. We talked about that already in these Psalms. But pay attention to what's going on in your heart at the same time. It's like David's prayer. Search me, O God, and see if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way of everlasting. When you say, God, why aren't you? Or God, you should have. Or God, I deserve this from you. You are standing in a place that you're giving evidence to the longing that you have in your heart that you have no evidence, no basis, no legal justification to stand before God in. And God is a just God. So David's reminding us that God owes us nothing, not even a simple meeting here in this sacred time of worshiping Him. And yet, God does meet with us here. God does order the steps of our lives. God does watch over us and bless us and takes care of us and listens to our prayers. God's Spirit does dwell with us and counsels us. God does bless us. God does protect us. We don't deserve it, but He does it anyway. So why, if I'm so bad, if I can't live up to this portrait of the blameless man or woman, why does God choose to pursue me even though I stand condemned? That's because there was another that was condemned in my place. Because everything listed here that we are not, God is. God is blameless. God does practice righteousness. God does acknowledge what is universally true. He does not slander or harm His friends or discredits His neighbors. God is never impressed by evil, never seduced by corruption, never confused about what is righteous and what is wicked. He lifts up those who honor Him. God does lend blessings from heaven, and He does not God doesn't lend blessings from heaven. He gives them. And He does not take bribes from the faithful on behalf of their family members. Church, God keeps His word, whatever it costs Him. And that cost came in the form of His one and only Son, who we can say in some mysterious way is also Him. He left His place of perfection to dwell among us. He met every single qualification on this list. One man has been pure in all of His thoughts, motives, actions, and responses, and that was the man who knew no sin. His name is Jesus, and He is the one of this very last line in this psalm. Psalm 15:5, the last half of it says, "The one who does these things will never be shaken." Church, my Jesus has never been shaken. My God has never been shaken. The one who does these things will never be shaken. So we are never going to enter in the presence of God. We are never going to enter life. Our longing is never going to be fulfilled unless we surrender in our disordered desires, our thoughts, our actions to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Isaiah 53 says that He was oppressed and afflicted, yet He did not open His mouth. Like a lamb led to slaughter and like a sheep silent before her shearers, He did not open His mouth. He was taken away because of oppression and judgment, and who considered His fate? For He was cut off from the land of the living. He was struck because of my people's rebellion. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, but He was with a rich man at His death because He had done no violence and had not spoken deceitfully. You see how the psalm qualifications are paralleling what the prophecy about Jesus was going to be? Yet the Lord was pleased to crush Him severely. When you make Him a guilt offering, He will see His seed. He will prolong His days, and by His hand, the Lord's pleasure will be accomplished. After His anguish, He will see light and be satisfied. The answer to longing will be satisfied. By His knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and He will carry their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him the many as a portion. He will receive the mighty as a spoil because he willingly submitted to death and was counted among the rebels. Yet he bore the sin of many and interceded for the rebels. The Bible, the scriptures, the psalm, the preaching that I've done today to accompany the psalm, it's all meant to shake you to recognize that you are not actually hungry. You're thirsty for living water. Don't you dare walk away from here thinking, well, I've got this list of 10 things that I need to do better, and that's not the point. The point of this psalm is to humble you. Not to give you a to-do list to go out and try and accomplish this week and feel like a failure and walk away because you're like, well, I can't live up to this. No, you can't live up to this, and that's the point. The Bible, the music, the prayers, the preaching, it's not here to stroke your ego. The scriptures expose your ego so that you can see yourself truthfully and shake you from the lies that you deserve whatever God can give. Because when you believe God owes you, you forfeit the sweet relief of the gospel. You only ignore the longing that's driving you toward the sin you wish you could rid yourself of. The question isn't, what are you going to do now? Yes, there will be things to do. There are responsibilities to carry. We've got to strive to be obedient in this life. I'm not trying to make less of those things. There will be people to love, places to serve, decisions to make, wrongs to forgive, commitments to keep, conversations to have. But that question, as the first question we ask, sends us out from the gospel. It does not send us out with the gospel. It trains us to supervise our lives when God is asking for us to surrender our lives. You get what I mean? Like, you got to keep track of all of your little sinful things. When we see one kind of getting out of control, we're like, get back in that cage. You know, while we're getting this one in the cage, this one starts getting out. Get back in. You know, we got to supervise this little circus that we got going on because we're keeping the sin around. We're not surrendering it to God and say, take it all away. So what do we do now is not the first question. The first question maybe is this: who am I becoming? Who am I becoming? This is the question that asks where your longing is taking you to. Because we're all longing for life, not just existence, not just survival, not just a few good moments sprinkled into the stress, not just enough comfort to make the ache go away for a while. We're longing for the life that we were made for. And Psalm 15 tells us where that life is found. Lord, who can dwell in your tent? Who can live on your holy mountain? Images that describe the centrality of God's presence in our lives, the necessary center of your heart, of your mind, of your soul. Because that is where life is promised. That is where life is really found. With the author of life, the protector of life, the one who breathes life into existence. As we try as hard as we can, like we tried as hard as we can, but we can't claim that life on our own. Like we've tried to find life in comfort, and comfort doesn't stop the anxiety. We've tried to find life in control, and control only makes us more practiced in fear. We've tried to find life in being right, but being right never actually makes us feel whole. We've tried to find life in being useful, and usefulness has just worn us out. We've tried to find life in people, and those people let us down trying to carry the weight of being our God. That's why our souls are restless. We're not simply hungry for something more. We're thirsty for the living God, and the God that we cannot climb up to has come down to us. Jesus is not a religious add-on to help us have a better life. He is the life. Jesus was shaken for us so that we could become steady in Him. We're not just trying harder to become the kind of person that God can tolerate. We're coming to the one who has made a way for you to dwell with God. So we come thirsty. We come exposed. We come tired of pretending. We come with the ache that we've tried to quiet with everything else. We come with the life that we've been trying to manage, fix, prove, and hold together. And in giving it all over in surrender to Jesus, we find the life our souls have been longing for. Not because we finally made ourselves worthy of God's dwelling place, but because Jesus has made a way for us. And when our lives are found in Him, Psalm 15's promise begins to become true of us. The one who does these things will never be shaken. Not because we're unshakable, but because Jesus is. So when your soul feels restless, when the question rises again, what am I supposed to do now? Maybe start with a deeper question. Where am I going for life? What have I been running to for life? Because life is found in God, and through Jesus, God has invited us to dwell with Him.